This interview is a continuation of a three-tape interview with Father Malachi Martin. And we are discussing the conflicts going on both in the world and in the church. And we were recently discussing the position of Christianity in the Middle East. And we had just discussed the fact that Muslims have a devotion to Our Lady. Father, do you think that perhaps Our Lady may yet bring Muslims back into the Christian fold by virtue of the fact that they do have this devotion?
I've been personally convinced of that as a personal opinion for many years. I don't think Our Lady does anything by accident. I don't think God allows anything to happen by accident. In fact, I don't think there are accidents in this world at all of God, even when there's evil rampant. And the fact that Muhammad, in spite of all the defects that we Christians see in him and his doctrine, because really Islam is a Christian heresy. That's what it really is. In spite of all that, I think that Our Lady ceded the means of converting Muslims finally to the reign of Christ. After all, Christ is honored in the sacred book, the Quran. He's a prophet, and he's honored. And you cannot dishonor him according to Muhammad because he is a prophet. They don't admit, they don't believe that he is the Son of God. There was only one God called Allah, and Muhammad was his prophet, is the great saying of Islam. So I do think that Our Lady did in her... See, she has a cosmic stature now, Our Lady. She is the queen of the cosmos. She was crowned that when she was assumed into heaven. And I think in virtue of that, she and God have laid out a plan for the conversion of men, including Muslims, to Christ's faith and to Christ's doctrine. So I do think that the presence of Our Lady in the Quran, the devotion to Our Lady, is so huge, and the connection between Fatima, the key geopolitical event of this century, and Muslims and Our Lady, is so thick that logically, I am led to say, she has her plans in those regards too. I must tell you, Bernard, one of the most moving things in my life was in Algiers, way, way many years ago, going to a shrine of Our Lady, which is an underground shrine in the middle of a street. You descended down into a semicircle with a statue of Our Lady and the child Jesus. And most of the women kneeling there and standing and praying were Muslim women. They were praying to the Virgin, Maryam, as they call her. So there's this real devotion. And you know that all the saints, and the one who really propagated the idea and insisted on it was Alphonsus Liguori. He said that anybody with a devotion to the Virgin has to be saved because she's mother. She will not let any child of hers who loves her be lost. And there's no doubt about it that it is a sign of predestination to have a devotion to Our Lady. And those that have not got it, you can doubt about their final destiny in the next world. So from every point of view, I have personally been convinced for many years that there is a big turn coming there. And you know, Bernard, in God's plans, the way God works, the way he uses things, with his long-range view and his knowledge of everything that's going to happen, no doubt about it, the Gulf War that's taking place at the present moment is leavening Islam. We are now in the middle of Islam. It's no longer forbidden ground for us. We can walk around there. They love to have us. In fact, you know, the joke that they had was that the national anthem of the Saudi Arabians changed in the middle of the Gulf War. It was Onward Christian Soldier, because there were so many Christians fighting for Saudi Arabia. But it does make the point I'm making, that we now are acceptable to them as friends. We weren't before. We were dirty infidels who bought their oil. Now it's different. So I guess God is, there's a leavening process there, and it's going to go on because God is all-powerful. And he finally brings all the ends of and strings of events, he brings them to the final pattern that he wants to create out of the human race's history. Now, that's so much, that's as God's Our Lady. There's a far more distressing fact about the Gulf War.
Let's talk about the Church's response to the Gulf War.
Yes, the Church's response to the Gulf War is something which distresses me an awful lot. Look, Bernard, the Catholic Church is arranged in such a way, it has a structure of bishops, and those are under the Pope. And the attitude of the Church on major questions, and the Gulf War is certainly a major question, and the New Order is certainly an essential question. Normally, the word descends from the Pope to the bishops, and they repeat and hand out what Catholics must think about, say, the Gulf War. Now, you have noticed, and everybody has noticed, that we have got no leading thought, guidelines, from either Pope or Vatican or bishops. Some bishops have said it's a great war. Some people, most of them in this country, are against the war on the Gulf. And but I want to talk about the Holy Father for a moment in this connection. He is John Paul II. He is a geopolitical pope. He is widely traveled. He knows every government that's at war at the present moment. He knows them all by name. He sat down with them in their private rooms and talked with them, as well as visiting their people. He's known. And he's a geopolitical pope in the sense that he thinks of the world as one vast chessboard in which there are various things being moved around, and he has to move the pawns and the kings and the knights that belong to the church in that vast game of politics. Because at that level of geopolitics, religion and geopolitics are linked together. There's no division. Now, why hasn't he spoken about it explicitly? Well, there's a tradition in the church, which we must examine, and this is a very important point for Catholics. For instance, take Pius the XII. I know personally, and anybody who's researched the subject knows, that Pius the XII, Papa Pacelli, as they call him, Eugenio Pacelli, was personally responsible for the saving of 1.3 million Jews, himself personally. Now, that's apart from what his priests and nuns did by hiding Jews throughout Italy and throughout Poland and throughout France and Belgium, which they did. But he himself personally saved 1.3 million. Yet, Bernard, if you mention Pius XII's name in the presence of modern Jews or modern Christians, they say, but he didn't say anything about Hitler's horrors. They blame him still. Why? Because now for about 150 years, it has been the policy of the Holy See, when nations are at war, not to speak about the right or the wrong on either side. And therefore, Father Pope Pacelli, Pope Pius XII, came out with general statements like, war is bad, racism must be condemned, people must not be persecuted on account of their ethnic background or their religion. General statements, which never pinpointed anybody. It just came general statements that applied to all sides. And the policy of the Holy See has a reason. For instance, when the Argentine and Chile were squaring off to fight in the early 80s, the Pope sent an emissary over there, and he met them both in Montevideo, and they arranged a peace. But before that, the Pope said, just condemn war in general as a recourse to settle arguments. Never mentioned Chile, never mentioned the Argentine. The policy has been never to mention two warring nations, because they both are praying to God. The priests on both sides are saying Mass, that their side wins. You know what human beings are. So the Holy See said, we will abstain from pinpointing any particular country, but we will talk about the general principles. That was fine and dandy when it was nation against nation, or even a group of nations against a group of nations, an empire against an empire. But something radical has changed in our world. What's the change? The change is that for the first time in 6,000 years of history, there is now a moral consensus on the part of the majority of nations to create a community of power. That changes the whole equation. Changes it to such a way that we are now faced with the fact that our country is going to be aligned with others. It may be the leader economically or militarily or diplomatically, but it's aligned with others whose will it must share in deciding the fate of the world. It's not the fate of America, the fate of France, or the fate of Iraq alone. It's a big geopolitical decision. In that case, to my simple mind, in this case, the Pope, the Vatican, should have come out with a white paper describing exactly what Saddam Hussein had done and saying, this is unacceptable. And come out with another white paper on the coalition of the nations and the UN and say, they have no right to insist that Saddam is wrong since they have been so wrong themselves. And they're going for money and for oil. Be specific. I think this is the time when we finally have to drop the general idea of talking about principles in general and pinpoint international, transnational villains and transnational sins. Take Lebanon, for instance. Lebanon has been distressed for 15 years, yet all that's come from the Vatican or from anybody is general statements about we must peace, we make peace, we must have dialogue, we must seek amity. It doesn't help anybody. It doesn't pinpoint anybody. The church finally, I think, has to come out and state quite blandly, and knowing that it will be attacked by one side or the other, this is right and this is wrong. They did wrong in doing this. The invasion and rape of Kuwait were morally wrong and unacceptable. And that has not been done. The result is that Roman Catholics are divided. They don't know what's right and what's wrong morally. They don't know what side is Christ's. A lot of them will say America's on the side of Christ. A lot of them will say, no, Christ is on the side of the Arabs. At least they have Islam. They're religious. Sure, there's a very naughty gentleman called Saddam Hussein there. And there's no moral judgment given, and therefore we're confused. And that's the mark of the church today. There is no clear moral instruction given by the authentic and authoritarian voice of the Pope and of the Vatican. And as far as our bishops go, there is no recourse whatever. They are as confused and as venal as the politicians are. They haven't come out with any clear statements at all. They've tried some. We had three bishops on national television with some commentators. One of them was Roger O'Mahony of Los Angeles. And the way these three bishops talked, you'd think that they were having a gentle scholastic discussion in the seminary while people were going to die and moral consciences were going to be revolted or were going to be twisted. They were afraid to come out with anything. They were afraid to back the U.S. government, afraid to back away from it, afraid to back Saddam Hussein, but afraid not to back him. You know, it's a completely spineless morality.
And I think that's why I have found there's absolutely no consensus whatsoever among Catholics about what should have been done.
None. And you know then what happens, Bernard? The terrible thing happens. Okay, we join the armed forces. And I'm in the tank corps. And you're an airman. You're a pilot. Now, we all know, with any experience, that if I'm in the tank corps and you're in your plane, you will not function properly unless you're prejudiced against the man you're going to attack. Unless when I see a tank, I say, well, my goodness, I've got to destroy that guy. And anger and the lust to kill must be in my heart. I can't be mild or meek. I can't say, hey, if you don't move out of the way, war is war. I have to have the anger and the lust to kill and the lust to maim and the lust to destroy. Those are sins, unless the war is just. And similarly, you with your plane and your precision bombing, you see you're going to bomb this particular area here, and this particular area is going to, the civilians are going to be killed as well as military men. You must want to destroy it. Otherwise, you won't press that button, you won't pull that lever. So war does funny things to men. Everybody who's been to war, he will tell you that's going over the top of a trench to attack the enemy. You've got to want to kill him. Otherwise, you're going to be killed. So it does arouse up these passions, and unless they are justified by the moral law and therefore endorsed by the church you believe in, the Roman Catholic Church, and by its highest authority, you're launched in a sea of vague morality. And what takes over? The natural passions. The natural passions. And the idea of true patriotism is lost, and love of one's country, and compassion for the enemy, compassion for your neighbor, is lost. It has to be. Now, we have had great restraint, but our avoidance of civilian targets and our compassion is politically motivated. We want to corrupt the Iraqis and draw them away from Saddam. We also don't want to get a bad name and get public opinion against us because we wanted to hold our coalition together. So we get the coalition could obtain the aims we have in mind, which are oil and profits. So, you know, without clear moral direction, and there's one or more aspect to it, there's therefore no respect for the Catholic Church's voice. Because it's silent. It doesn't take a stance. And therefore there's no respect. Because this world does respect one thing. If you stand up and you make it stick what you hold for, they respect it. And there's still a lurking respect for Saddam Hussein that he held on in spite of everything. We respect this even though we condemn him and say he's crazy, he's a madman, he's a looter, he's a killer, he's a rapist. There's this. And the Arabs are full of it, too. He stood up to 33 nations. Sure, he lost, but he stood up to them. He told you to go to hell. That's their attitude. And we admire him for that, and they do. Now, they'll lose that when they find out that their oil is gone and their economies are affected and the Jordanians are going to start having pains in their bellies and the Iraqis are going to be hungry and finally they'll fling him out because he's ruined their country. But the mere fact of resisting and standing for what you hold does evoke admiration. If it does it in the case of Saddam Hussein, how more so in a group of people who stand for morality, who say, no, this is wrong or this is right, whatever is the stance. And it does, too, be the strength of armies. Remember, it is the strength of armies. They have a moral stance. They're morally persuaded of it and not persuaded merely for career purposes. It's the job. There was a Marine colonel after one big battle with Saddam Hussein's tanks in the KTO, the Kuwaiti Theater of Operation, was asked, well, how do you feel about it? He said, this is a job I'm paid to do. There was no trace of love of America, love of freedom. No, he's paid to do it. And he does it well. But that is amoral. I mean, there's no morality at all in it. I have a job to kill you because you're the enemy. I'll kill you. Now, without a directive from the church, based on the doctrine of Christ, and not on a mealy-mouthed Christ who turns the other cheek. Christ never turned the other cheek, by the way. The one time he was struck in the cheek in the house of Caiaphas, he didn't say, strike the other one, please. He turned round to the man who did it, and with a face that that man will never forget, here in eternity, he said, why did you strike me? If I've spoken ill, say so. If I've done something wrong, if I've done nothing, why did you dare strike me? That wasn't turning the other cheek. This idea of turning the other cheek is not Christian at all. But there is a doctrine of the just war. There is a war, doctrine of Christ's aim in the world. And that has not been laid out from men. And increasingly, as we walk into the new world order, with its stringent control of our liberties and the reduction of our influence in religion and education and in public morality, we're going to find the voice of the church not there. And therefore more confusion. And people saying, well, the church hasn't spoken. I'll take my options. And we know where those options go.
Let's take a look now at the church's response to the Soviet Union and to communism and the situation in Eastern Europe.
Well, Bernard, first of all, we should have a small review of what the Eastern Europe is like and what Russia is like religiously. It's essentially that, you know, whenever you want to comment, I found anyway, whenever I want to comment on a situation in a particular part of the world, the basis of it is good intelligence about conditions. So the first thing is, what is religion like over there? What is the mentality over there? Now, no matter what anybody says about faith and about the Russian church and the Orthodox church and the perseverance of the faithful in their religion, this must be said about both the Russian, the Soviet population and the populations of all five satellite countries. You cannot perpetuate a public lie for 45 years, through radio, television, newspapers, and education. We are two generations, almost, in a lie about communism and about God and about faith, which the communists did, without that bastardizing their mentality. The point I'm making here is the point everybody makes about the Soviet Union. When they go over there and come back, they say, these people have been mongrelized. They've been bastardized. They have no morality of work, of duty, or responsibility. It's survival. They've been driven down to the lowest level you can get. And therefore, there's no unity amongst them. There's no nobility of cause. They're not inflamed with a new ideal. There's no ideal coming from religion. And this is the same in Czechoslovakia, and in Hungary, and Yugoslavia, and Poland, and in East Germany, now part of Germany, and in the Soviet Union. So that's the condition of things. Now, there is certainly a body of Orthodox believers that have clung onto their faith and are now coming out with their processions and with their celebrations and have taken over churches. Almost 4,000 churches have been opened since Mr. Gorbachev came in 1985. It's part of his policy. Let them have their playthings. Let them have their churches. There's no harm in that for him. And the Pope has chosen a certain number of priests and he has dispatched them to Eastern Europe to teach them what has gone on in the church since Vatican II, because they know nothing about it. They haven't got the Novus Ordo Mass. They haven't got the new doctrine of religious liberty. They haven't got the new doctrine about women priests, because the majority of those going into Eastern Europe are now Jesuits. And the Jesuits, as you know, are anti-papal, and they're strictly neo-Catholic. That is, they haven't got officially they don't profess papal doctrine any longer. They have another form of Catholicism, which in my opinion is not traditional Catholicism. The difficulty is that the populations in those countries and in Russia want only one thing, liberty. But liberty spells certain things for them. They want VCRs, they want cars, they want refrigerators, they want contraceptives, they want easy abortion, they want travel, they want good salaries, they want silken sheets in their bed, they want plentiful food, they want supermarkets. They're not looking for worship, they're not looking for belief. They have been driven so low, they've been so mongrelized, socially and personally, and as a group, that they are no longer looking to the horizon to say, now let's see what God's face is like. No, they don't. They want the good life. The good life. Now, there is a solid core of believers still, say, in the Ukraine, which suffered much. There's a solid core of believers in the Lithuania. And there's a solid core of believers in other parts of Russia. But there is no overall yearning and thirst for Christianity, for Catholicism. It doesn't exist. It's been killed off. The Russian Orthodox Church was the main author of that, because the Russian Orthodox Church officially prostituted itself. And it consented to conditions that meant it was going to go down. Conditions like what? Well, in 1946, they condemned the Ukrainian Catholic Church. They went along with Stalin's idea of bayonets, killing off 4 million of them, 4 million of them, and then 16 million later in the hunger that Stalin initiated, called the Harvest of Sorrow by the Americans who have studied it, and they then consented that the highest echelons, anybody above a simple priest in the Russian Orthodox Church, would belong to the KGB and would inform on the church. And the church has always supported Stalin's wars and always supported Stalin, preached adhesion to the motherland under the banner of Lenin. It prostituted itself. And I remember meeting the Russian clergymen who came down to the Vatican Council and saying to them, why did you do that? Two of them in particular, the two observers that Khrushchev sent down. And they spoke excellent English and excellent Italian too. And they said to us, we have had to live in hell, and we don't think we're ever going to get out of it, both politically, morally, and religiously. They know they had gone wrong, but they couldn't do anything else. They were helpless. So this is the situation there. Now, there is no upturn in that situation. There are no vast converts. You know, we make 16,000 converts per day in Africa, 16,000. We lose 7,400 in Western Europe every day, by the way. We lose it by death, by divorce, by apostasy. In Russia, there's no vast conversions. People are not interested. They're after the good life. They want what we have. And one of the reasons for being angry with Khrushchev is that he hasn't brought capitalism in fast enough for them. So there's no upturn there at all. On top of all that, it would be ridiculous if anybody suggested that Mr. Gorbachev was seeking the kingdom of God. The policy of Khrushchev is Leninist. He wants to institute the atheistic state dreamed of by Mr. Lenin and Mr. Stalin and Mr. Khrushchev and all the other people, Brezhnev and all the others that preceded him. He is an agent of the devil, and there's no doubt about that. Now, with that conditions, with that exact intelligence about Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union, there is no hope there, except that Our Lady, blandly and quietly and gently but firmly, as only she can say, told Lucia that the safety of the world, that's the safety of you and me, of your Canada and my United States and Western Europe and the rest of the world, the safety of the world will be achieved because Russia will be converted and she will do the converting. So Catholics will be very wrong if they think that there's the present Pope and the present Vatican and the present Roman Catholic Church has now got a huge field of harvest of souls and it can create a huge wave of conversions. Don't have that delusion. Our Lady made it quite clear that Russia will spread its errors throughout the world and would ruin the world, except that she will convert it by a miracle. There's no vast conversions coming.
This is a very important point, because very often people in the West have romantic ideas about Christianity in Eastern Europe.
Oh, yes, they have. They have, and it's, I know. You can meet people from Eastern Europe, and I've met them, and I talk from Russia and from the other, the Baltic countries, and also from the former satellite countries. You meet them, and you're touched by their faith. The faith is woven into their language. In Russia, for instance, in Russian, when you say пожалуйста or спасибо, please or thank you, those words are laden with Christian ideas, and I won't waste your time by going through them, but they mean beautiful things, Christianly speaking. But they're used now like please and thank you. And Mr. Gorbachev says пожалуйста and спасибо, and he simply means nothing religious by it. The whole thing has been prostituted. But we have marvelous ideas about Russian icons and Russian monks and the pealing, reverberating chant of the monks in Zagros Monastery and this ancient religion that has slept, that has persevered through the dark night of persecution. No, it didn't persevere through that. It prostituted itself. It became a member of it. It supplied its force. It gave it inspiration. It dragooned Christians into the Leninist armies. It went along with the killing of citizens. It went along with the killing of all the Catholic bishops in the Ukraine. It consented to that. Oh, no, no, no. This church is guilty beyond belief. Do you know that when Romania broke, as it were, had its revolution, you know what happened to the Russian Orthodox clergymen? They fled the country. Because they had backed the regime. They had backed Ceausescu, the butcher of Bucharest. And therefore, they were going to be killed. They fled. To give them their due, the Catholics had not done that. They had just done nothing and lived underground, as all religion did. So there is that dreadful condition of Eastern Europe. And those who said that, Our Lady is already converting Russia when the Berlin Wall fell down. Oh, gee. It almost brought tears to my eyes, the wishful thinking in that.
This is a controversy now. Do you think that the consecration of Russia has already been done?
Oh, no. Oh, no, 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 no. Nobody in his right senses thinks that. Now, there are priests and bishops that speak like that, but they're speaking either out of ignorance or malice. The consecration of Russia is a very definite thing. It's a very definite thing. I mean, it's like saying, do you know Bernard Jansen? Yes, I do, because I've seen his face. I know his nose and his hair and the height and where he walks and talks. The consecration of Russia, the consecration, according to Lucia, was very simple, but very exact. It had to be a formula used by all the bishops and the Pope on the same day. The same formula. It had to be worldwide. It had definite things to say. One of the things it was going to say was the errors of the Soviet Union, the errors of Russia. And that at the same time, that was to be done, the third Fatima secret, the hidden letter, was to be published. That's the consecration. It has to be collegial, by all the bishops in union with the Pope on the same day, and if possible, giving the variation of the various hours across the time of day at the same time and accompanied by the publication of the letter. That has not been done. What has been done is what could be done. Pius XII twice consecrated the human race to this to Our Lady's Immaculate Heart, and he mentioned Russia. And John Paul II, when he was over in Fatima, consecrated the human race, and he mentioned Russia. That's not what Our Lady asked for. So the consecration has not been done. And any effort to say that the consecration done on March 24, 1985, by the Holy Father in Rome, is the collegial consecration urged by Lucia, by Our Lady to Lucia, Lucia to us, is either, as I say, ignorant or malicious.
Well, the fruits simply aren't there. As you mentioned, Eastern Europeans are turning to Western materialism.
Yes,
they're not turning to Christianity.
No. And you see, it's also a crass way of thinking of Our Lady, because Our Lady says very little. Well, when she says it, she means every word of it. And when she said Russia will be converted, she meant Russia will be converted. Not that they sort of, as we say, put creases over the trousers and take baths and use deodorant. That's not conversion. That's not conversion. Conversion means they turn and acknowledge the rule of Christ through the Roman Catholic Church on this earth, in the name of Our Lady, the Virgin Mother of God. That's conversion. That has not taken place. There is no sign of it. There's no upturn, whatever. There's no light at the end of the tunnel. In fact, we're still in the middle of a tunnel in the whole matter. But a lot of interest. You see, Bernard, there's one more fact which I think we should bring to the notes of everybody, if they don't know it already. Within the church and churchmen, there is a substantial body of bishops and cardinals who are utterly opposed to two things. They're opposed to the Roman Mass, as we used to know it, prior to Vatican II, and they're opposed to anything to do with Our Lady. They don't want any news of Fatima. They don't want any news of Garibandal. They don't want any news about Akita. They don't want any news about Lourdes. These things are forbidden. They no longer are useful. The church must now merge with the world and lose all this hocus pocus, this nonsense, this superstition. Now, the fact that that is the way, and that from the Vatican, not from Pope John Paul II, but from members of the Vatican, has come an effort to muzzle Sister Lucia, which has taken place, and also to inspire several people writing in America and England and Europe and Australia to attack Fatima and to denigrate it and put it in a lesser light. This is a sign that Satan, as Pope Paul VI said, the smoke of Satan is around the sanctuary and around the altar. He's within us. He is penetrating. He has got inside the walls. So education is taken out of our hands, and we have consented to it. And there is no gainsaying the damage that has done. Now you meet young people who don't know the Hail Mary or the Our Father, can't make an act of contrition, don't go to confession, go to Holy Communion if they have to, don't know what is in Holy Communion, they think it's bread merely, blessed by a priest. And who wants bread blessed by a priest? It's far better to have something they buy in a pizzeria, or they buy in a McDonald's. They haven't got the faith any longer. Simply, they were not taught. They don't know anything about it. I always remember the time that I brought a young man in to a Catholic church, and over the altar there was hanging a crucifix. He'd never seen a crucifix. And he said, when he saw the blood and the crown of thorns and the wounds, he said, "Why did they do that to the poor guy?" He didn't notice Jesus. Jesus did not connote crucifixion. And as you know now, we haven't got crucifixes, we have resurrexifixes. That is a picture of Christ being resurrected in glory, and he doesn't look like Christ at all. So the education of the young is lamentable, and there is no movement to make it any better at all. And the recent row between the American bishops and the Vatican over education ended in the Vatican retiring, and the American religious establishment being allowed to totally secularize their education and have Marxists and lesbians and homosexuals with equal rights on Catholic campuses, teaching about condoms, teaching about the homosexual way of life, teaching about euthanasia, because they want to be in the swim. They want to be like the others. They want to buy into the system, and the system is amoral. So the condition of the church, the perspective on it, is very sad from that point of view. And the fact is then that it's also riven by factions within. The vast majority of Catholics in Western countries have now been weaned away from the church as it was. They no longer pray the same way. They no longer worship the same way. They no longer think the same way. Fast and abstinence has gone out. There's fast and abstinence, that's medieval. You don't do that any longer. That's cruelty. It's sadism. It's psychologically twisted, according to the modern doctrine. You must have sex. And there are bishops in this country who send young priests to institutes run by non-Catholics where they're advised to go out and have a woman or a boy in order to become healthy-minded and to masturbate. This is official. And I'm not mentioning the name of those bishops or the name of those priests or the name of those institutes, but that's what happens. It's thoroughly being secularized. That's because faith has disappeared. Faith has disappeared from the church on the whole. And by the way, this is what Our Lady said in Fatima. Faith would disappear, except from Portugal. Except from Portugal.
Now, this leads in very well to an issue which seems to be becoming the crux or the focal point of the battle for Catholicism. And that is the area of the priesthood. Because the liberals have seemed to have gunned for the priesthood as the area in which to make even further changes within the church.
As they have.
Why do you think they chose the priesthood?
Because without priests, you have not got people who offer the sacrifice of the Mass. We can talk about that in a moment, but just think about priesthood. The attack on it is huge. The attack on it is so successful that when you make a survey of the bishops, say, in the USA, you become convinced that most of them don't want priests any longer. I know bishops who call up young priests whom they can't get to conform to their neo-Catholic stance. They tell them to go away. They laicize them. They leave them without any money. They leave them without any work. And they lack priests in their dioceses. They lack them. They have done nothing about their seminaries. The seminaries themselves, many seminaries are rife with homosexuality, where it's approved to be healthy. You must experience sexuality with your fellows. Besides going to the local city or the local wherever you want to have sexuality. Now, the priesthood is under attack because without a priesthood, a solid priesthood, which is faithful in doctrine and which reproduces the doctrine of Rome, the Roman Catholic doctrine, and is faithful to the Pope, you're not going to have a Catholic population. There was a saying always when I was a young man, and it's true, that if there isn't a sermon on Catholic morality and the papacy at least once a year in every parish, that parish is going to go to hell. It always does. Now, I've been in this country 27 years, Bernard. I have never yet heard, in the thousands of churches I've been in, I've never heard a sermon on the Pope. Never heard of someone on the papacy or on Peter's authority. Never once in 27 years. Count all those Sundays. See, I'm 65 of them. Not once. Never once from anybody. Never once. And there's never an article on the papacy. There's never a study of the papacy, an examination of its claims and its authority and its history, except to abuse it. Except to abuse it. Scurrilous stories told about this pope or that pope, or about whether the pope is wrong, or what a foolish man he is, and his present pope is just a Polish archbishop that wandered by mistake into the papacy. The desecration of it all. But the idea is to do away with priesthood. The thing that really militates against the popular taste today about priesthood is celibacy. You see, they regard, nowadays, in the society in which we live, the expression of sexuality, whether within marriage or outside of marriage, whether by yourself or with somebody of the same sex, or with an animal, is regarded as quite normal, if you don't frighten the horses, so to speak, provided you don't violate any rule of decent living. The idea that men, young men of 20, say, take a vow of celibacy, that they will never get married, and they can keep that without getting twisted and psychologically moronic, and finally ending up in pedophilia or in sadism or in some twisted psychology. That is the normal attitude to priests today. So the idea of Roman Catholic celibacy is something that is utterly alien to the mind. Why? Because the idea of priesthood is, and this is where the great lack in teaching in seminaries and in the Catholic populace lies. You see, a priest, Christ was once asked, what do you think? They pointed out a eunuch to him. A eunuch was somebody who accidentally, for some reason or other, couldn't have sex. His genitals were destroyed or something. And somebody said to him, Lord, what do you think of the eunuch? Well, he said, there are three kinds of eunuchs. There's the man who's born like that from nature, deficient in other words, he hasn't got the wherewithal. There's the one who men made a eunuch, because they used to castrate people to make them eunuchs. Because eunuchs were very useful in palaces, because they wouldn't touch the women, and they were very good guards. And eunuchs then always developed a very great cruelty, I suppose, in reaction to their mutilation. And then the voice, if you did that, the voice remained high-pitched and beautiful well into teenage. And then he said that there's a third kind of eunuch who does it to himself for the sake of the kingdom of God. And then he said, very mysteriously, whoever understands, let him understand. Qui potest intelligere, capiat. Who can understand this, understand. Meaning there's a very deep mystery. The mystery is this. I can look at my celibacy, if I'm a priest, as a chastity belt, and the church has locked it and thrown away the key. In that case, then, I'm just somebody deprived of what I should have a right to by a greater force. They've thrown away the key. That's not celibacy at all. That's enforced continence. I can look at celibacy then as something which is acceptable to the church, but is a pain in the neck or a pain somewhere else. I still am very far from it. The celibate is somebody who says to himself or herself, a nun, my greatest power of love is in reproduction and in living with another human being and in having children, and exchanging our love and warmth and friendship and confidence and giving each other the intimacy of our very being, soul and body, which a true marriage does. But I will give that up because when I become a priest, Christ puts a seal on my soul, the seal of his priesthood. And that seal cordons me off for a higher destiny. And the destiny is to have a very, very, very particular union with God, with Christ. And that union is the union of somebody who's going to hold God's body in his hands at Mass, and who's going to be a special emissary, bringing blessing and shriving people from their sins and healing their souls. That's what true celibacy is. It's a segregation of your soul from all the lovely things in life that human love can bring and marriage can bring. By the way, look, it also has its ills and its difficulties. But in general, it's regarded as a great benefit to be married or to live with somebody, as we do nowadays. But to cut that off deliberately and to do it lovingly and to make it a positive contribution and to devote all the energies that nature has given us for human love, devote them to Christ, and to concentrate all that on the sacrifice of Christ and the preaching of his gospel and the transmission of his message of love and salvation to souls and healing them and shriving them and helping them and supporting them, guiding them and welcoming them to the truth. That is the highest vocation a man can have. It is in the order of perfection. It is a higher order. Similarly with a nun who takes a vow of celibacy, a vow of chastity, the same thing. She says to herself, I'm going to imitate Our Lady, who is a virgin, who is a mother of God. I'm going to have spiritual children. And most of Our Lady's children are spiritual. She had only one child of her own called Jesus. But I'm going to have those children by my prayers and by my identity with the Great Mother, the Mother of God. And I'm going to do that by renouncing this, not because it's ill or bad. It's not bad. It's good. God made it. It's good. It's good. He said, increase and multiply. Love each other. Be one flesh. It's a sacrament in the new covenant. But I'm going to renounce that because I want to have a greater identification with Our Lady, because God is calling me to that. And all the love and the sympathy and the empathy and the perceptiveness of love, I'm going to transfer that to Our Lady and Our Lord. And I'm going to make that my special sacrifice. And in the beginning, it is a sacrifice. And then with the passage of time and fidelity, suddenly this flower blooms in their souls. And they achieve this marvelous tranquility and this marvelous warmth that people always saw in the traditional nun and the traditional priest. This amazing power to get inside them, this light, this feeling that they were there for you. They weren't riven in their sympathies. And they were there for you because Christ was their man. Christ was their king. Christ was their high priest. That idea of priesthood. Bernard, you won't find that anywhere today in Catholic manuals or preached from sermons or anything like that. Celibacy is regarded as a sort of like fish on Friday, a law that we want to change and do away with. Many want to do away with. Many bishops want to do away with. And Father Richard McBride of Notre Dame has written very, very, very succinctly that he's looking forward to the day when Mrs. Pope comes out on the balcony with Mrs. Pope, with Mr. Pope, and gives their joint blessing to many, many married priests and married nuns down below. I mean, if a man like that, teaching in a Catholic, so-called Catholic college, university, the University of Notre Dame, can write that and say that in public and contradict Catholic doctrine, well, two things immediately come to your mind. First of all, he ceases to be Catholic. And secondly, he's a very, very insolent man to propose that irreverently. He just doesn't understand. And I just wonder what on earth he regards his celibacy. How does he act, really? Celibately? Certainly not in his mind.
And what would be the consequences of a married priesthood within the Catholic Church?
Well, I'll tell you what would be the consequences of it. You know, Luther, in his last speech, he died suddenly at night after a big banquet. And he gave his most vituperative speech about the papacy. And by the way, Luther could turn the air blue with his language. They will not translate some of it into English. They leave it in old German. And when she said it, even the German stinks. It turns your ears blue. But in the middle of it all, he said, he had married, as you know, he had married a nun called Catherine Bormann. We still have their rings. And he said, let us all marry nuns. Let nuns and priests marry, and let us go forth and convert the world to Christianity, and let those crook-shanked Roman celibates die out. Well, you know, Bernard, that was in the 16th century. And in those 4 centuries, the crook-shank Roman Catholics went out and they converted and made a church of 900 million. The married clergy of Protestantism, of various kinds, brands, and descriptions of Protestantism, have lost out. They didn't convert anybody. They shrank and shrank and shrank down to the miserable remnants that they are today. Lifeless, without vibrancy, without any direction, whatever, and losing hand over fist. If we are bad, in a bad condition, they are in a terrible condition. They're eviscerated ruins. The point is this, I am making to you, that if we were to do that, we would immediately change the face of priesthood. Because it is an apostolic fact that priests must be celibate. An apostolic fact. We know that Peter took his wife with him wherever he went, except when he went to Rome. But they lived in continence. And the law in the early church was, you see, they had very few people to ordain priests then, so they picked any man, a married man, an unmarried man, mostly married. And when they ordained a married man, he and his wife had to take a vow of celibacy. They lived together because it was a sacrament, but they were celibate. Then when they got a bevy of young men in the later years, they started ordaining them and imposing celibacy. The practice of a married priesthood came in as an abuse tolerated by the Holy See. And it was only tolerated in the Greek and Russian church, in Eastern Christianity, as we say. It was never tolerated in the West, where they maintained the celibacy. If you haven't got a celibate clergy, well, sociologically, the change is very interesting. Because first of all, you have to support your wife and children. That's an economic factor. Number two, there's the fact that the unicity of the priest, his unique devotion to his parishioners, is gone. He has a wife at home. And he goes home at night, or he goes home during the day. And she knows all about the parish and the parishioners. And immediately you change the equation of parish priest to parishioners, even sociologically. And personally you change it, because then I know that you're not completely independent. There's a woman talking to you. She's your wife. You love her. I remember when I was a chaplain to the U.S. Air Force in Turkey, having to make long trips with the officers that went up to see the radar domes on the Black Sea, where we ringed around Russia to listen to what they were saying. And one of them said to me once, after a long discussion, 18 hours driving, he said to me, you know, Father, he said, I couldn't talk to you like this if you were married, like Woody. Woody was the Protestant chaplain, a very decent man. He said, I couldn't talk to you like this about these things. I wouldn't dare do it. He said, because you'd have a wife, and you can compare yourself, and she could. I mean, he said that it's the end of the priest-client relation. And it's true, sociologically. Spiritually is the biggest change, the most significant change. The change would be this, that I would have into my life the interests, the passions, the needs, the mentality of other human beings closer to me than any parishioner, anybody confided to my care spiritually. I am going to be diverted at least, therefore, from it. And my judgment is going to be molded by the people I live with, namely my wife and my children and their in-laws. You change the whole equation immediately. You change this man from being somebody totally dedicated to the people in principle, of whom is the parish priest, to somebody who is there fulfilling a job in charge of the plant. And that's a different thing completely, and wipes out the relationship that the church has established between the parishioners and the pastor itself. It doesn't work, we have found. It just doesn't work.
Now, while we're on the subject of the priesthood, an issue that is very high in many people's minds is that although there is a shortage of priests, there also are a number of very good men who are priests. But it seems like there is a persecution of these priests.
Yes, there is. There is. Listen, let me give you a personal anecdote in this matter. I, at the present moment, am in contact and in close correspondence with 23 priests in these United States, all of whom have been suspended by their bishops. By the way, they haven't offended sexually. They haven't stolen money. They're very zealous. They want to say Mass. They want to hold Stations of the Cross. They want to hold Exposition of the Blessed Sacrament. They want to organize pilgrimages to Fatima. They, in other words, want to reproduce traditional Catholic devotional practices. The bishop doesn't want that. And these bishops, four bishops mainly, have insisted that if these men will not submit to psychological training and rehabilitation, because they must be rehabilitated, they say, then they will not give them any work. And the tactic always has been to give the man, for instance, his insurance money, his insurance, his health insurance, let him have $750 a month for about a year, and then if he hasn't changed, if he hasn't submitted and gone to the institute to be remodeled psychologically, they terminate him. And they say, see you gone on Monday, Father. We don't need you any longer. And these are dioceses that lack priests. That is what has been done. And number two, then, there's the fact that in many dioceses, at least anyway, I can count many, the bishop now allows women concelebrate with priests to get the idea of a priest, a woman being on the altar. And they allow their nuns, who are on the television or radio, advocate the ordination of women and the marriage of priests. So there's definite bias against priests in many bishops' minds. They just don't want it. And they have said so openly. There was a meeting there last year in South Bend, Indiana, where many retired bishops said, it's about time the Pope ordained women. It's about time the Pope permitted the marriage of priests. So the bias against the priesthood is large. And, you know, Bernard, when you reflect on it, the bias against priesthood is due to a lack of devotion to Our Lady. Because if you think that a priest shouldn't be separate from the people in this matter of celibacy, if you think he should be like ordinary men, then you've lost the idea of what her son was like. He was completely dedicated to his work. He was celibate in a way which none of us can be on account of his being God and being Jesus, the Son of God, and on account of his extraordinary humanity that God gave him when he was born. And he was the son of Mary, a virgin, a celibate. If you do away with that idea, it means you have no devotion to Our Lady. It means you don't know what she was, what her son was, what her whole function was. And it means that you have a very funny idea of sexuality. You consider it either good or bad. And if you don't share it, you think it's bad, and that's twisted. If you do share it, then that's good. And that's the only way to be human. And this is non-Christian, it's non-Catholic, it's anti-Catholicism. And this, unfortunately, is a very rampant idea amongst our bishops and our priests, too. They have very little idea of what celibacy means, and they're anti-priest. Now, there's also this. Remember that nowadays the function of the priest has been reduced by the new practice, liturgical practices, which leads us into consideration of the Mass, which we'll deal with in a moment. But that makes out that the community is the important thing. The priest is not important. He's just a minister, like he's in charge of the plant. Make sure that the heating is working and that the pews are clean and that there's some nice music and nice choirs and that the roof doesn't leak. That's more or less the idea of a priest now. He's a manager of the plant.
There's no reason why, let's say, a woman couldn't be the manager of that plant.
Of course not. In fact, they make far better managers. They're far more careful about these things. So why not? So the broadside attack on it is terrific and is organized and is going to go on. And bishops have caved in on this. And some of them want women priests now. And they certainly want married clergy. So the fight is going to go on this.
Have some of the bishops caved in the area of women priests?
Oh, yes, they have. It's still a secret. But we know of one bishop, he's now dead, who ordained 32 women. At least he put them through the ceremony of ordination. And they say Mass every morning. And we know in Canada there are three groups, at least, of women who have their chalices and their vestments and say their Mass in private, waiting for the day that they will get permission and they will come out then as priests, priestesses. This has already happened, and it was inevitable. And I would be willing to take a small bet, not being a gambling man, that one day, out of the blue, some foolish bishop is going to stand up and say, I am ordaining five women who have been studying theology. They're just as good as any man, and let Rome do what it can. And what can Rome do? I bet you it's going to happen. They're going to do that. And then some other bishop is going to say, I'm going to ordain married men and let them live as married men, and because I need priests, which is the funny, twisted way of dealing, having dismissed good priests, having made it impossible to produce good priests, then turning around and going in the back door. It's satanic. It's the satanic attack on the church, because if they get rid of the priesthood, as we know it, the church is finished. The church, as a visible institution, the church is finished. There's no doubt about that. But they won't succeed in that. Just the battle is very tight, and we're not getting vocations.